Islamic perspective. This week, our hearts, thoughts, and prayers are still focused on the people of Palestine amidst Israel's ongoing attempt at a genocide of the people of Gaza. The Israelis have now launched their ground invasion, but are facing stiff resistance, incurring major losses before they've even reached into major urban areas. In this episode, we will be exploring the outpouring of support for Gaza from across the Muslim Ummah and compare that to the ridiculous positions taken by the rulers of most of those nations. We begin by having a look at which Muslim governments have relations with the Zionist entity and which ones still steadfastly refuse to normalize.
Ever since the founding of the Zionist entity in 1948, its leaders have waged an obsessive campaign to seek the approval of the international community of nations, and one area of focus has always been on the Muslim world. A year after the entity's founding, Turkey established ties, making it the first Muslim country to do so. Although, of course, the Turkish Republic at the time was fiercely anti-Islamic and aggressively secular, more so than it is today. It was in 1978 when the first Arab state recognized Israel, with the signing of the Camp David Accord by the Egyptian president Anwar Sadat, paving the way to a treaty between the two neighbors. Jordan followed suit in 1994, with King Hussein signing the Washington Declaration on the White House lawn during the presidency of Bill Clinton to establish his country's ties with the entity. It wasn't until 2020, with the intense lobbying pressure of President Donald Trump and his Zionist son-in-law Jared Kushner, that more Arab countries normalized ties with Israel, with the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan all signing up to the so-called Abraham Accords. But of course, many Muslim and Arab countries refused to sign deals with Israel, with Iraq passing a law last year criminalizing any attempts to normalize with Israel, while countries like Lebanon and Syria still have land that is occupied by Israel, and they refuse to engage at all with the Zionist entity. But perhaps the most consequential position taken by a Muslim nation vis-a-vis Israel is that of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Following the overthrow of the Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in a U.S.-UK-instigated coup in 1953, the reinstated Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi quickly established ties with the Zionist regime. Those continued until 1979, when the return after 15 years in exile of Ayatollah Khomeini culminated in the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And with it, not just a total cutting off of all ties with the Zionist regime, but a story of almost 45 years of political, financial, and material support for numerous anti-Israeli resistance movements. Which leaves one glaring question about another major power in the region. Before the Al-Aqsa flood operation, reports emerged of an impending normalization deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia, but with the Muslim world enraged at Israel's genocidal massacres and Saudi placing the blame for the latest violence squarely at the door of Israel, it would appear, for now at least, that those moves to normalize are dead in the water.
Joining us today on the show are two very special guests. Sister Noor Fekri is a business owner and politics graduate with a keen interest in West Asia. She successfully used social media to shine light on religious and political events in a way that is accessible to the everyday person. And we are very honored to have joining us today in the studio Dr. Ali Al-Kabani, who is an Egyptian journalist based in London and former director general of the Islamic Press Agency, with a specialism in Middle Eastern affairs. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Thank you so much for joining us. Doctor, if I can start with you. So let's set the scene a little bit, especially as an Egyptian yourself. Egypt hasn't cut ties with Israel yet. You have Sisi, who, you know, constantly makes comments about his time with the Jewish community and how he grew up with them and normalizes, you know, those kind of links. And then you've also got the people of Egypt being suppressed from protest, and it took weeks for the crossing to even be opened. Why has Egypt taken this position?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First, we have to recognize that the Egyptian regime does not represent the Egyptian people. So are all Arab regimes. They are put in their place by the United States, and they are acting as the United States called them client states who take their dictates from the White House and they implement it. And the day they don't do that, they will be out of power in their countries. Donald Trump said it clearly. The Saudi regime would not stand for 1 week without the American support. So it's very clear that those Arab regimes, they do not represent the people they rule. That's one thing. The other thing, Egypt Sadat signed the so-called peace treaty with Israel in 1979, which I call surrender treaty, because they got back the Egyptian land of Sinai, but they lost sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And the Egyptian army is not allowed to go into part of the land, which is Sinai, without the permission of the Israelis until now, after 45 years of signing this surrender treaty. The same King Hussein of Jordan signed a surrender treaty without getting anything. He could have insisted of getting back the administration of the West Bank or Jerusalem. He didn't. He just signed this surrender treaty for nothing. And I would say that Israel never withdrew from Arab land they occupy after the war of 1967 without such a humiliating negotiation for years. The Yasser Arafat gave up armed struggle with Israel after signing the Oslo Accord. Mm. Oslo Accord said that the Palestinian will have a state after 5 years of signing this treaty. Again, 40 years passed and the Palestinian PLO got nothing. They only withdrew without any humiliating treaty or any negotiation from Gaza and from south of Lebanon, thanks to the Islamic resistance in both areas. So when there is occupation, there should be armed struggle. When you give up the armed struggle, you get nothing but humiliation and ignorance. So Egypt, to come back to your question, of course the Egyptian people support Gaza 100%, but the regime cannot do anything. The Sisi's regime allowed the people to express their feeling and demonstrate only because of the pressure put to him by the Western government to open the Rafah crossing and implement the so-called deal of the century by the transfer of the Palestinian from Gaza to Sinai to live there permanently. Israel is saying temporarily, but the idea is to transfer the Palestinian and let them live in Sinai and leave Gaza for Israel to annex Gaza like they did with all the occupied Arab land.
And speaking of pressure, so it's not just the pressure that the people are putting on their governments in Egypt, it's also the pressure of the people worldwide that are now having an effect. You know, Nour, if I can come to you, you know, we've seen the huge question of are protests and boycotts working? You know, what's the use? We've got thousands of people on the streets. They're taking days off of work. Do they really have an effect? What can you tell us about these kind of protests across the Muslim world?
Yeah. So the protests that have been taking place aren't just across the Muslim world. We've also noticed all of these protests taking place in Europe, for instance, in London, where we had over 500,000 people marching together to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And the way I sort of measure the effectiveness of these protests and these boycotts is by looking at the reaction of elites. Look at the reaction of the Israeli lobby. Look at the reaction of Suella Braverman, for example, by trying to ban the Palestinian flag. Or, for instance, the reaction of Keir Starmer that fired Andy MacDonald for simply asking for a ceasefire. These are sort of extreme measures, and the reaction from these from sort of the Israeli lobby and from Western governments goes to show how effective these protests are. And that's because, as well, the Israeli regime will attempt as hard as they can to make sure that the Western public opinion remains pro-Israel. So when this now that they're losing sort of the monopoly on the narrative, that then puts pressure on Western governments to change their stance towards the Israeli occupying entity. And we saw that with Keir Starmer, for instance, when he sort of did that U-turn, when he went onto LBC and incited genocide and said that Palestinians don't deserve water, electricity and fuel, and then had to U-turn the next day and go for photo ops with leaders of mosques, for instance. And so these protests sometimes can actually create tangible change on the ground. I mean, we saw the Iraqis that went to the border with Jordan and said that, you know, they refused for subsidized oil to go from Iraq into the Israeli occupying entity. We saw protests happening in Egypt where people are camping by the border, by the occupied Palestine border, asking their government to open the Rafah crossing to allow aid and the injured to come in. You know, these protests have erupted, for instance, in Jordan, where we've got, you know, a massive population of Palestinian people. And that sort of, you know, we saw that even Queen Rania had to come into CNN to now, you know, even though Jordan takes a position of, you know, normalizing with Israel and, you know, has ties with them, but what was almost felt obligated to come out and speak for the Palestinian people because it was almost embarrassing not to. Mm. The same with Turkey's Erdogan. You know, he has you know, open relations with the Israeli entity, but had to sort of come out and say the Palestinians have the right to, you know, have the right to resistance because it simply would have been embarrassing not to say that. And when it comes to sort of creating real tangible change on the ground, we, you know, the US may or may not call for a ceasefire if people, you know, start to step on the US toes. If, for example, the people in West Asia begin storming the US embassies, you know, they wouldn't want their interests sort of jeopardized. So they then might call for a ceasefire. And in terms of sort of boycotts as well, boycotts have also been extremely effective. I mean, we saw McDonald's and Starbucks handing out, you know, free burgers to the IDF as if, you know, a lot of the IDF soldiers are actually obese. They don't need any more burgers. Instead of giving, you know, food and fuel and donations to the people of Gaza that are literally facing a genocide, they have decided to, you know, offer freebies and goods. And, you know, these are capitalist multinational corporations, and where it hits them and hurts them the most is in their pockets. So I would say continue with protests, continue with boycotts, because they are effective.
Asante, I think that you mentioned quite a lot of the effects that have been enacted on the ground in lots of, not only just in the UK, but obviously, and you didn't mention Lebanon. I remember seeing this video of the people just literally, like, in their thousands, in their cars, just rushing to the embassy to kick these ambassadors out of their offices. And do you know what? As someone who regularly goes to these protests and actually asks people for their opinion, I definitely feel that that feeling is coming to the UK. And what we're going to be seeing now is, in contrast to how many Muslim leaders have reacted, ordinary Muslims have also been active in showing their solidarity to the Palestinian people. Ayon Islam spoke to some attendees at a recent protest in London to ask them if they felt these leaders were failing in their responsibility to the Muslims of Gaza.
As a Muslim, it's shameful. It's absolutely shameful that these major world powers with a lot of wealth, a lot of oil, all they could have done was turn off the black taps, yeah? That's all they had to do. And they could have helped the narrative, okay? I think, you know, turning off the taps to countries like America and Israel, that would have had a major impact, okay? And I think all the Muslim countries have been very slow talking about it, never mind the actions. The actions have not come at all. If anything, Qatar has been outspoken about the whole thing, but again, there's a lot more they could do, and it's shameful. As a Muslim, I'm completely ashamed of the action or the lack of action or reaction from the powerful Muslim leaders of this world.
I don't believe this is a war just against Palestine, but it's an injustice and a war between the evil and the good, because that's what we're fighting. And I just want to say that we're not scared. As a Muslim, as a convert, we're not scared. We trust in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We trust in God. We trust in the humanity. And they're all united that to this, to end with the Zionists. And that we know that even in the Quran says this has to happen. So we just have to keep our faith strong and remain together as humans. It doesn't matter what the big countries are doing or not doing. The main thing is that we remain together and we have our faith strong.
Now, the Muslim nation, there are 56 Muslim countries that could do a lot more. And so far, really happy to see what Qatar is doing. It's a small nation, and yet it's very involved and very vocal. They are keeping ties with Hamas, with the brothers as well, so with other Muslim countries, and that's how you're going to get support, whereas other Muslim countries have broken the ties with Hamas, which you cannot have a negotiation if you can't have a tie with them. Really disappointed with other countries. Yesterday, the United Nations had a resolution to push through for a ceasefire. As much as not binding and it's probably just a little soundbite, you've seen countries like Iraq abstain from it, Tunisia abstain from it. It's very shameful. At least speak out. We're not going to see anyone act on it. We're not going to see any sort of support from any Muslim countries. But for God's sake, at least speak out. When you have a voice, speak out and say something.
Well, no one can doubt that the views of the London population are definitely with the people of Gaza. Doctor, if I can come back to you. Nord mentioned slightly about the oil and, you know, the Iraqis going to Jordan. Why haven't the countries cut the oil? I remember that there was a statistic that said something like a sixth of the world's oil is with the countries. You know, if they were to cut the oil, that would cause a shock to the global economy, surely, and it would put the West on notice. Why haven't they done that?
Because we don't have statesmen in the Gulf area to do that, like what we saw after the 1967 war and 1973 war, where Faisal of Saudi Arabia cut gradually the oil production. He didn't boycott completely, but cut the oil production by 5% every month, and we saw the effect on the West on putting pressure on Israel. So we don't have statesmen to do that now. We don't have Arab unity and Muslim unity to see that killing and the genocide we see in Gaza today affect every Arab citizen in the whole of the Arab world and every Muslim citizens in the Muslim world. So if they have that feeling, they would have certainly hurt the Western interests, because the West is blindly supporting the Israeli genocide. And we hear Joe Biden saying that we will stand with Israel today, tomorrow, and every day. It means that forever they are supporting Israel blindly, which make Biden, the United States, and the Western governments complicit to the war crimes committed by the Zionist entity. So this is the situation now. While all the West are supporting the Israelis, none of the Arab world supporting the Palestinian really strongly and effectively. Okay, the Arab street is protesting and demonstrating, which is good in exposing their own regimes and their failure to help the Palestinians. But there is no action really to support the Palestinians by oil ban to the West, and also boycotting, as Noor said rightly. Where is the Arab boycott, which we used to practice until the 73 war? It made a lot of international corporations change their attitude towards this Arab-Israeli conflict.
You know, the question of Arab unity is definitely something that lots of people are talking about. And I think when Yemen said that they've declared war against Israel, so many people in the Muslim community felt very empowered by it until they realized it was the Houthis who did it. And then yet again, you know, that brief moment of unity was like, oh, no, they're the wrong type of Arab, the wrong type of Muslim.
Because the West call and Israel propaganda, any resistance to the occupation is terrorism. Any resistance to oppression is terrorism. When was resisting occupation and oppressors and land grabber called terrorism? So at least, again, as Noor said, the protest in the Western capitals exposed their regimes again, that what we are seeing in Palestine is legitimate resistance, it is not terrorist act. And as the Secretary General of the United Nations said, that Hamas attacks did not come out of a vacuum.
And that's definitely something that now the public are starting to acknowledge, you know, that they're moving away from this narrative of, oh, it's just started on the 7th of October. They're looking at it in a greater vacuum, absolutely. In a greater context. Nord, if I can come to you about Iran. You know, we were just briefly mentioning about, you know, Arab unity, Muslim unity. You know, has Iran done enough?
Okay. Well, Iran, unlike a majority of Arab countries, has stood by the Palestinian people from day one. If I can just remind everyone that during the 1980s, when Iran was going through one of the most brutal wars, where the world powers conspired against Iran in an eight-year brutal war, they still sent men to Lebanon, to South Lebanon, and to Palestine to fight the Israeli invasion. So they have always stood by the Palestinian people and always extended a helping hand and never fell short in that sense. Compare that to, for example, the Palestinian Authority themselves, Mahmoud Abbas, when the Ma'badani hospital happened and the people in the West Bank went out to protest. And, you know, it was a televised genocide, a televised war crime that took place. And he shot at his own protesters, killing and wounding quite a few of them. Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, they've all been involved in sort of stopping the Yemenis from launching missiles into the Israeli occupation entity, almost protecting it. Just want to remind the world that Iran actually spearheads the resistance axis. What does that consist of? Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, the Palestinian resistance. In Lebanon, Lebanon is involved in a direct confrontation with the Israeli occupation entity on the southern Lebanese border and the northern occupied Palestine border. They have literally covered the entirety of the Lebanese border for the first time ever. Who funds and who supports the Lebanese resistance on the Lebanese border? It's Iran. You know, we've got the Yemenis. Who has supported them throughout their struggle when, again, the world powers conspired against the Yemeni people? They quite literally starved them to death. They were boiling and eating leaves for 8 years, and yet they still stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people and stand with justice. And so Iran, you know, when you ask Netanyahu, for example, who's the greatest threat to you, he will repeatedly say Iran, Iran, Iran. And therefore, that should be a clear sign that Iran is the only entity that is standing in the face of the Israeli occupation entity. It has also funded the Palestinian resistance that before the axis of resistance used to support the Palestinian resistance. Now it is the Palestinian resistance that supports the axis of resistance, because they are positioned in such a strategic location within the belly of the beast, the heart of the Zionist entity. And they've gathered so much strength. Now when we say, you know, is Gaza standing alone? Is anybody supporting it? It doesn't even need anyone to support it. It is now a force to be reckoned with. The Palestinian resistance is a force to be reckoned with. We can now call the Palestinian resistance Arab leaders that are standing up for the Palestinian cause.
And well said, Noor, but I want to interfere here that we have to remind ourselves and the viewers that Iran, from day one of the Islamic Revolution, when Imam Khomeini went back to Tehran, he cut all diplomatic relations with Israel. He expelled the Israeli ambassador, and he gave the building of the Israeli embassy to the PLO at the time when nobody in the whole world recognized it as an embassy for the PLO in Tehran. So the support of the Israeli, the support of the Palestinian case is a clear strategy of Iran from day one.
I don't think that there's any question on the fact that the resistance globally wouldn't be where it is if it wasn't for Iran's stance on this matter. What an incredible discussion. I wish we had time for more. Thank you so much to both of you. And thank you at home. I hope to see you again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
As the Zionist settlers and forces kill Palestinians with impunity, the Israeli regime is intensifying Palestinians' physical and social repression. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, while the world is preoccupied with the fierce Israeli regime war on Gaza, there is less interest in what is happening in the occupied West Bank. This is understandable and natural, given the large scale of destruction and killing in the Gaza Strip. The West Bank and Gaza were occupied by the Israeli regime in 1967. According to the United Nations and the international community, both territories were supposed to form a single political entity, the foundation of Palestinian state, as part of the so-called two-state solution. But reality has not gone in this direction. Gaza, completely separated from the occupied West Bank since 2005, has endured a comprehensive Israeli regime siege and five wars, during which thousands of Palestinians have been killed. Meanwhile, the occupied West Bank is suffering from illegal settlement expansion that is devouring Palestinian private lands. Around 700,000 settlers live in approximately 150 settlements and 128 outposts, and this number constantly increases. These settlers, who have become widely represented in the Israeli Knesset and were recently handed weapons by the government, are soldiers in civilian clothes. Some have formed armed militias to kill Palestinians under the pretext of maintaining security. Across the occupied West Bank, Palestinians suffered greatly from the Israeli occupation before October 7th, and their suffering has only intensified since then. In the village of Khosra, settlers, under the protection of the Israeli regime army, killed four Palestinians last month. Settlers also killed a farmer in the village of Al-Sawiya while he was picking olives on his land in front of his wife and children. Also last month, in Deir Estia, settlers attacked Palestinian olive pickers and distributed leaflets warning them to leave for Jordan or risk being annihilated in a second Nakba. Every year, Zionist settlers attack Palestinian farmers during the olive harvest season. This is the most important agricultural season for Palestinians. Palestinians greatly depend on it for their livelihood. Zionist settlers often burn trees, steal crops, attack farmers, and seize land with no accountability or punishment. Rather, they enjoy the support and protection of the occupying army. This year witnessed the peak of such attacks. Under the pretext of retaliation for the October 7th attack, Palestinians in areas near settlements and main streets have been prevented from harvesting their olives. The Zionist regime's extremist finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, has called on the government to create buffer zones free of Palestinians around the settlements and to prevent Palestinians from picking olives in these areas. Israeli regime authorities have also cut off water to Palestinian residential communities, while neighboring settlements enjoy water 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Before October 7th, Israeli regime forces had killed around 200 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the start of this year, 2023, and more than 170 others have been killed since that date. The Zionist regime forces have invaded the cities of Jenin, Tul Karm, Nablus, and Ariha, destroying infrastructure under the pretext of searching for wanted persons. Israeli regime also maintains severe restrictions on freedom of movement for Palestinians, with 700 road obstacles and checkpoints across the occupied West Bank. The Zionist regime forces have locked up neighborhoods with iron gates while giving Zionist settlers total freedom of movement across the territory. Palestinians are not allowed to enter the settlements established on their stolen lands, as they are surrounded by fences, barbed wire, and strict security measures. And while Palestinians live in the same geographical area, the laws and legal procedures for Palestinians and settlers differ. Israeli civil and criminal law applies for settlers, while Palestinians face a military court system. According to reports, before October 7th, more than 5,000 Palestinians, including children and women, were being held in Israeli regime prisons, including hundreds in administrative detention, without charge or trial. Since October 7th, that is within just 1 month, more than 2,000 others have been arrested across the occupied West Bank. Arrests are often made after violent raids, and many prisoners say they have been tortured and abused in Israeli regime custody. The Zionist regime is also cracking down on pro-Palestinian online posts, aided by social media companies that have restricted and blocked content supportive of Palestine. At the same time, Palestinians followed in astonishment the collusion of Western regimes with the Zionist regime in its crimes against Palestinians. They feel frustrated by Western double standards on human values and freedom, as evidenced by the glaring difference in their responses to Ukrainians versus Palestinians. Palestinians are disgusted by hypocritical Western rhetoric about civilians on human rights. Western officials loudly denounce the killing of Israelis while trumpeting Israel's right to defend itself. Yet, they appear largely indifferent to the thousands of innocent Palestinians who have been killed by Israeli regime forces in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. The ongoing killing and displacement of Palestinians will not bring peace to the region. It will do the opposite, serving only to intensify the conflict. It is an illusion to believe that peace can be achieved without justice. The only way to resolve the conflict is through a political solution that ends the occupation and holds war criminals accountable.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Welcome, dear listeners, to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned.
جهنم هم میگن هفت در داره، هفت در داره جهنم ها. وقتی این هفته چرا هفته، چطور هفته؟ من فکرش کردم، حالا به دیگران فرمودند، حالا من هم بزنم.
In the ahadith and narrations, we read that hell has seven gates. The question is, why seven gates? I searched a lot for the answer to this question and find this answer. The major reasons for our committing sins in this world are seven organs of our body: two ears, two eyes, mouth, tongue, and the sexual organ, which are totally seven. Through these seven organs, I violate the divine orders of Allah. In other words, through these seven organs, I am opposing Allah. These seven organ sins have effects on my actions and decisions that I make in life. This means that physical sins are not only limited to the organs, and they influence other aspects of our lives too. Therefore, there are seven gates in the hell, and there are seven entries for committing sins in this world, which must be taken care of.
جوانهی تابع جوارحیه، اونم تابع. ولذا هفت در جهنم هم داره.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
United Nations officials have called for urgent international action to end Israel's ongoing attacks on Gaza hospitals. we take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The regional directors of several United Nations agencies have called for urgent international action to end Israel's ongoing attacks on hospitals in the besieged Gaza Strip, where the Israeli regime has brought under its unrelenting genocidal war. The regional directors of the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, and the World Health Organization, WHO, made the appeal in a joint statement on Sunday, 12th of November. They said they were appalled by the regime's attacks targeting either the main buildings or the periphery of hospitals located in Gaza City, including the Al-Rantisi Pediatric Hospital, the Al-Shifa Hospital, and the Al-Quds Hospital, and other hospitals located in the north of the blockaded territory. The Israeli occupying regime started its war of genocide against Gaza on 7th of October after Operation Al-Aqsa Storm was carried out by the territory's resistance groups. More than 11,000 Palestinians, including 4,506 children, have been killed so far and 27,490 others sustained injuries in the Israeli regime's ongoing onslaught on Gaza. Israel has also cut off the flow of basic supplies such as water, electricity, medicines and fuel to one of the world's most densely populated territories. Gaza houses over 2 million Palestinians. According to Gaza's health ministry, 21 out of 35 hospitals with inpatient facilities have stopped functioning in Gaza, either due to damage from Israeli attack or lack of fuel. Over the past 36 days, the World Health Organization has recorded at least 137 Israeli attacks on healthcare facilities in Gaza, resulting in the killing of 521 people and the injury of 686 others, including the killing of 16 members of the health staff and the wounding of 38 others, the United Nations officials said in their joint statement. They added that those Gazan hospitals which are still functioning are under massive strain and can only provide very limited emergency services to patients, life-saving surgeries and intensive care services. Describing Israel's attacks on medical facilities and civilians as unacceptable and a violation of international humanitarian law and human rights law, the joint statement said, "They cannot be condoned. The right to seek medical assistance, especially in times of crisis, should never be denied. The world cannot stand silent while hospitals, which should be safe havens, are transformed into scenes of death, devastation and despair. Decisive international action is needed now to secure an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza, to prevent further loss of life and preserve what's left of the healthcare system in the territory." The joint statement by United Nations officials said, "Unimpeded, safe and sustained access is needed now to provide fuel, medical supplies and water for these life-saving services." Earlier on Sunday, 12th of November, the Deputy Health Minister in the Gaza Strip said an Israeli aerial assault had destroyed the cardiac department of Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest medical complex in the besieged enclave. The Deputy Health Minister in Gaza, Yusuf Abu Rish, said, "The facility had been flattened as fighting raged on around it. The occupying regime completely destroyed the cardiac ward of Al-Shifa Hospital. The two-story building has been completely destroyed in an airstrike." In an interview with Agence France-Presse, Yusuf Abu Rish said the hospital, which is situated in northern Gaza, is currently surrounded by Israeli tanks and faces a blackout as its last generator is running out of fuel. Meanwhile, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, has sounded a stern alarm about the humanitarian situation in the besieged Gaza Strip, which has been under Israel's genocidal war for the past 38 days. The situation in Gaza is rapidly approaching a humanitarian disaster, the International Committee of the Red Cross warned on Sunday, 12th of November. An unbearable human tragedy is unfolding in front of our eyes. People call us day and night saying They're afraid to open their door for fear of getting killed and pleading to help them reach safety. William Schoenberg, the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross's sub-delegation in the Gaza Strip, said, "As a humanitarian worker, I feel frustrated not to be able to respond to these calls as our teams lack basic security conditions to move in northern Gaza Strip." The Israeli regime started its war on Gaza on 7th of October following an operation by the territory's resistance groups. More than 11,000 Palestinians, including 4,506 children, have so far been killed and 27,490 others injured in the Israeli regime's ongoing onslaught. The International Committee of the Red Cross also expressed alarm at Israel's targeting of heavily populated urban areas, saying Israeli attacks taking place in heavily populated urban areas in the Gaza Strip, including around hospitals, endanger the lives of the most vulnerable people like medical staff, patients and the wounded, also people with disabilities and the elderly. The International Committee of the Red Cross's warning came as thousands of Gazans have embarked on a perilous journey from the northern part of the coastal territory towards the south amid a short-notice evacuation order by the Israeli regime. The International Committee of the Red Cross said it is gravely concerned by the precarious and unsafe conditions under which civilians are evacuated as a result of the Israeli aggression. Men, women and children waving white flags walk for dozens of kilometers past dead bodies lying on the streets and without the necessities like food and water. At the same time, the International Committee of the Red Cross teams in Gaza and hotline operators received numerous calls from displaced people searching for their family members. It is paramount that members of the same family are not separated during evacuations. The ICRC also warned that the southern areas of Gaza Strip are not well equipped to cater for the massive influx of people arriving with nothing but their clothes that they are wearing. And the quantity of humanitarian aid coming in, the ICRC said, is not sufficient. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. The regional directors of United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, UNICEF, and the World Health Organization, WHO, on Sunday, 12th of November, called for an urgent international action to end attacks against hospitals in the Gaza Strip. The call came in a joint statement from Leila Baker of UNFPA, Arab States, Adeli Khodr of UNICEF, Middle East and North Africa, and Ahmed Al-Mandhari of WHO, World Health Organization, Eastern Mediterranean Region. The world cannot stand silent while hospitals, which should be safe havens, are transformed into scenes of death, devastation and despair, the United Nations officials stressed in their joint statement. Decisive international action is needed right now to secure an immediate humanitarian ceasefire and prevent further loss of life and preserve what's left of the healthcare system in Gaza. The joint statement added, unimpeded, safe and sustained access is needed now to provide fuel, medical supplies and water for these life-saving services. The violence in Gaza must end right now. Citing World Health Organization WHO figures, the United Nations officials noted that at least 137 attacks on healthcare facilities in Gaza have been recorded over the past 36 days. Resulting in 521 deaths and 686 injuries, including 16 deaths and 38 injuries of healthcare workers on duty. We are horrified at the latest reports of attacks on and in the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital, the Al-Rantisi Nasser Pediatric Hospital and the Al-Quds Hospital, and others in Gaza City and northern Gaza, killing many, including children. The United Nations officials added that intense hostilities surround several hospitals in northern Gaza and are preventing safe access for healthcare staff, the injured, and other patients. Attacks on medical facilities and civilians are unacceptable and are a violation of international humanitarian law and human rights law. The joint statement by the United Nations officials said, attacks on medical facilities and civilians are unacceptable and are a violation of international humanitarian law and human rights law. They cannot be condoned. Israel has launched its relentless air and ground offensive on Gaza Strip, including on hospitals, residences and houses of worship, since a cross-border attack by the Palestinian resistance group Hamas on 7th of October. The number of deaths in the ongoing Israeli onslaught on Gaza has now surpassed the grim figure of 11,100, including more than 8,000 children and women.
The conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at the recent legacy bill that was passed at Westminster. How does this now affect victims, and what can be done to repeal it? My next guest is a columnist and regular political commentator on broadcast television. She is also Deputy Director of Relatives for Justice, a national victim support NGO which provides advocacy and therapeutic support for the bereaved and injured of the conflict. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Andre Murphy. Andre is a human rights advocate working on behalf of victims affected by political violence during the recent conflict. Andre Murphy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean. Lovely to be here.
Great to see you.
So, Andre, tell me a bit about your childhood growing up.
Well, I was born in Dublin in the 1970s, grew up in what was, I suppose, a really emerging Ireland at that stage. You know, it was very poor. There was a massive recession, especially during the 1980s. And we were just, you know, a family affected by all of that economic environment. When I was 15, we moved to Tallaght, which was at that stage a big sprawling housing estate where there was no footpaths. You had to go across fields to be able to get to a bus maybe every hour that ran. And I can remember it just being a little bit grinding. You know, that everything seemed in black and white in Dublin, where everywhere else looked like it was in colour, but I loved it.
And were you always interested in human rights, or where did that come from?
I think growing up in Dublin, and what I just described, where you'd be in a place where nobody had any money, and particularly women. And women at that stage had no effective rights. And, you know, I can remember when the marriage bar went in the civil service. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother, because my parents split up, received a benefit called the Deserted Wives Allowance. If you were a child, if you were unmarried at that stage, you got and you had children, you had a unmarried mothers' allowance and whatever. That was the type of society we lived in. Yet women ran everything while men were unemployed or maybe had to go away. Women kept Dublin running and the communities that we were in. And I can remember then that sense of, you know, we here have no money. We've no access to effective education. We've got women who are going through all of this. And, you know, where's the rights? Where are we as equal citizens? There is no sense of equal citizenship.
And you became Deputy Director of Relatives for Justice. What kind of, can you, just, for the audience's sake, tell us what kind of services that victims can avail of?
Yes, so Relatives for Justice comes from families coming together to say us too. So people who were affected by state violence in particular, their experience of violence and of violent bereavement was completely dismissed, where they weren't seen as equal victims. And so all of our services, whether it's advocacy where they're pursuing legal justice through different avenues, whether it's recording their own story, trying to break imposed state narratives or censored narratives, or whether it's even seeking support with the traumatic effects of that experience, was very, very difficult for many families. How do you go, if you've been affected by a state violation, to an arm of the state and talk about your life falling apart? You're afraid that the state is also going to perhaps take your children. You're afraid that you're going to be sectioned and taken away from your family. So for us, our support came very, very organically, where we were stepping into the places where the state had failed families. How can you support someone going to an inquest, for example, if they don't have money to be able to pay the rent or to buy food? How can you engage in any sort of education if you can't even walk through the door at night because you're so afraid because your father was killed at night and you've never been able to cross the door since? Those are the type of organic, connected support services we're able to provide now.
So, Andre, you've been nurturing victims for decades now. How do the people that you work with feel about the latest proposals that have been forced through the British government around legacy?
Michelle, I've been doing this for over 20 years with families who have seen the very worst of days. And the Legacy Bill is having an impact that I have never seen before. So for them, it is the British government saying their loved ones didn't matter. It's saying that what they did is completely okay. And it's saying they, as living relatives, and their experiences don't matter. It's saying that they are second-class citizens, that they are not beneficiaries of our peace process in any way, shape or form, that they are inconvenient, that they are to be dismissed. So for this is intergenerational. So we can think of people who, when their brother or sister were killed when they were children, they will talk about, on that day we lost our parents as well because the trauma was so horrendous and the silence descended on their families. So for them to be able to then 10, 20 years later, in the context of a peace process, pursue justice, record narratives, say, let's have due process for my brother or my sister, and their parents pass away and pass on a mantle to them. For this to happen now with this legacy legislation is telling that family that they are not only letting down their brother and sister, they're also letting down their parents. And the devastation... I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. That came out of nowhere. I'm really sorry. The devastation for that family is not about a piece of law. It's not about whether they can get into a court. It is about the erasing of the memory of their child, of their brother, sister, their spouse, their parents. That's what this is doing. And what that does to a family and its impact can only be seen through our phones the day after, where people are expressing suicidal thoughts. They're not just saying, I am traumatised, I'm not coping. They're saying, I want to take my own life because my life is no longer worth living. Not only was the life of my loved one taken away, but my life is no longer worth living. Chris Heaton Harris was quaffing champagne the night this was passed, because they think they've done a good thing, because they don't have to look in the eyes of these mothers who know they are going to die, who are going to die before their children's justice is delivered, the truth about their child, who was not a gunman or a gunwoman, who was not someone that the British Army could just take away and snuff out their life and then cover up the files and hide them away for until 2064 or 2070. Those women know they're going to die without having any of truth and without any justice. Chris Heaton Harris